Hi, this is Jeffrey Sachs of Antietam Rav Yeshiva with our ongoing study of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik's Halachic Man, sponsored this semester by Tiffany and Michael Beda in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichrono Livracha. Of course, along with the rest of the Jewish people and all people of conscience and soul around the world. Here in Yerushalayim, of course, we're very focused and fixated on the news, on what's been going on this past week, 5 days or so. There's, of course, our Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Chaim Brovender, who himself knows a little something about being kidnapped by terrorists, an incident that happened a number of years ago. And tonight's shiur is dedicated in the merit that our little bit of Torah study should hopefully tip the scales for Yaakov Naftali ben Rachel Torah, Gilad Michael ben Batalim, and Ayal ben Iris Teshura. And the shiur is dedicated by our friend and student Melvin Marsh in the American Southeast. So in the hopes that the three of them will be safely, even tonight, returned to their families. It happens, as is always the case, here in Israel, you know, rumors start flying on Friday afternoon that three kids have been kidnapped, and you have this sinking feeling in your heart that there's little chance that you won't know at least one of the families. Now, it obviously makes no difference whatsoever whether you know the families of one of the people connected or it's just another fellow resident of our little country. But somehow having a personal connection strikes it home much more sharply. It happens that the mother of Naftali Frankel, Rachel Frankel, who's become the spokeswoman for the parents. She spoke at their press conference today and the other day as well, quite passionately, quite articulately, quite emotionally, quite movingly. So she and my wife were chavrusas together in Brovender's way back when. And it's, you know, just that way that living here is, you know, being part of an Ir Shechubra Yachdav and Eretz Shechubra Yachdav, the levels of interconnectedness are such that that you really do have a sense of living in one very large extended family. So may our learning be in their merit of a quick and speedy return. Here we are at the end of chapter 9 on page 59. There was this discussion last week that we began about Tzimtzum. I hope that we demonstrated and we talk about Tzimtzum in the context of Halachic Man. We're talking about not so much the Kabbalistic idea that the Rav is using the concept in a different way. And then we got onto this topic of Halacha trying to objectify religiosity, not only through introducing the external act and the psychophysical deed into the world of religion, but also through the structuring and ordering of the inner correlative of the realm of man's spirit. But the purpose of halacha is to create outlets for our inner experience and to create objectified acts that can contain the fluid, liquid, individual expression, which the halacha viewed with a certain degree. Please be clear that I said certain degree of, shall I say, suspicion that if it were a religion merely of individual ecstasy, where everybody did what inspired them, that's not the, certainly not the Jewish worldview, and for most organized religion, it's something that's viewed with a bit of suspicion. That there's a tension between the collective and the individual, between the objectified act and the inner individual experience. And the idea was to take, to create a system that enabled the housing, the containing of the individual fluid subjective moment within a ritualized framework, so that, to use examples we've mentioned many times in the past, both in our study of halachic man and in other writings about myself, prayer. Prayer is meant to be this profound encounter between the individual and the divine, a communication, a colloquium, a communion between man and God, the sense of omed lifnei hashchina, the halachic definition of prayer. But if everybody were meant to pray in the way that perhaps the Avot prayed, most people would feel overwhelmed. Most people would not be able to meet that demand. And Chazal come and they create a ritualized, formalized, set prayer, which is still meant to give and to house the transcendental, ineffable, indescribable, individual experience of each person standing before God. Now, obviously, it doesn't happen automatically. Obviously, merely standing with your feet together, reciting the words, going through the rote ritual doesn't create it on itself, but it is meant to enable it to the degree that the only authentic way to pray is to pray through the mechanism of the set prayer. The halakha sets down statutes and erects markers that serve as a dam against the surging subjective currents coursing through the universal homo religiosus. Homo religiosus would probably prefer that everything be left individualized, that everything be left subjectified. But that would create this raging torrent of emotion, which can't be tamed, which can't be channeled, which can't be directed. And that's what the halakha is trying to do. And that subjective current coursing through the universal homo religiosus, which from time to time in its raging turbulence sweeps away his entire being to obscure the incoherent realms. Indeed, many halakhic authorities have even sanctioned, after the fact, the mechanical performance of a commandment, one lacking in intention. This leads us to the larger discussion of mitzvot srichot kavanah or mitzvot einan srichot kavanah. Does the performance of a mitzvah require special intent? Now, we're not here talking about kavanot, holy mystical incantations, even though technically speaking, it's always preferable that one have profound intention in what they're doing, profound kavanah. The reality is that the halakha requires merely an awareness that what you're doing is a commandment and that you are commanded. And that is the level of kavanah that is required for mitzvot. We can't always even attain that. So in the b'di'evid situation, so we just do mitzvot. We pray. We pray three times a day. We don't always achieve the kind of kavanah that we would want, but yet we keep praying. We keep at it. We keep getting up to bat. Even according to those authorities who declare that commandments do require intention, and again, this is a machloket, the halakha does not require of us any mystical, esoteric intentions. Directed towards hidden worlds, but only the clear, plain thoughts fulfilled by this particular act, such and such commandment. Heaps upon heaps of mystical intentions and unifications have been piled by the mystics to lead man's consciousness to hidden worlds. Now, perhaps you know from perusing various sidurim, there are certain incantations, certain formula that are placed before the performance of certain mitzvot. Sometimes they're written out in Aramaic text. Sometimes they make reference to different angels that are called in participate in what's going on, whatever degree we understand, whatever that means. In other cases, it's just a much more formulaic statement, often preceded with a hirotzon or a hineni muchanim zuman. Perhaps most familiar to those that recite the by Sfirat HaOmer, because there's a little tune, hineni muchanim zuman, hineni muchanim zuman, where we say, I'm ready, I'm able, I'm about to perform the mitzvah of Sfirat HaOmer, and then you recite the biblical text that constitutes the command to count the Sfirat HaOmer. But that same hineni muchan appears for many different mitzvot. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says that this whole calling on special intentions, calling on mystical unifications and formula, the intention accompanying the performance of a commandment appears in the halacha illuminated by the light of objectivity and lawfulness. Both the intention and the deed are part of the process of objectification. And then he has this quote, although interestingly it's not, it's only mentioned in the footnote where the quote is from, but he has a quote from the Noda de Yehuda. As to the view that an individual, before he performs a commandment, must state that he is performing it with mystical intention, we see that such mystical intentions, whether they accompany prayer or the commandments, often involve perverse and wayward notions and indeed border on the heretical. In some of these cases, it makes it look like we're praying to the angels or who knows what. And therefore, the larger misnagdish approach, the non-Hasidic approach, particularly that of the Lithuanian rabbis, was not to recite these things, never to say the Yihiratzons, the Inini Muchans. That's the purpose of the bracha. Chazal codified the obligation to recite brachot, asher, kedushanu, v'mitzvotav, v'tzivanu, fill in the blank. That's the declaration of Kavanah. That's all the declaration of Kavanah you need. That declaration that God commanded us, we are commanded beings, and what I am about to do is a fulfillment of that obligation. L'tkoa b'shofar, l'haniach tfilin, l'kboa mezuzah, al netilat yadayim, what have you, what not. It suffices to perform the commandment for the sake of the commandment. And any commandment which is not preceded by a blessing, there are certain mitzvot that don't have a bracha beforehand. So the Noda de Yehuda said any mitzvah that doesn't have a bracha, which the bracha itself constitutes all the declaration of kavanah that you need. So the Noda de Yehuda says, my practice is to recite beforehand, I'm performing this action in order to fulfill the commandment of my Creator. And that's all the kavanah that you need to know, that what you're doing is a mitzvat Hashem. And this alone suffices, and nothing more is needed. And the intention, the kavanah, required for prayer is simply understanding the meaning of the words. Minimally, what kind of kavanah does one need for prayer is to understand what it is that you're saying. And an awareness that you are standing before God, which for some reason is not specified. All great halachic scholars have acted in accordance with this decision. That the mystical intention, this is not the way of the halachic man. But it is the impulse of the homo religiosus. And then there's a story. Now, it's an interesting question. Why are there stories? It has something to do probably with the nature of Rabbi Soloveitchik's teaching and writing. It has probably something to do with the way in which this work was composed. But as opposed to, I'm not sure that we can think of examples and counterexamples. I'm not sure that most philosophical texts contain these kinds of anecdotes. I'm trying to think, let's say, of Buber, who was, of course, another very prominent Jewish writer and an expositor of Jewish thought, a bit older than Rabbi Soloveitchik, but more or less around the same time. I'm not sure that you have these kinds of anecdotes in many of Buber's works. Think of non-Jewish philosophers and theologians. I'm not sure that you have these kinds of anecdotes. But here's an anecdote. It's a very well-known anecdote, both to people that know this work well and even if you don't know the word, you may be familiar with this story that the Rav tells about his father. Here's the Rav's father. The Rav's father was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the son, of course, of the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Rav Chaim Brisker, as he was known, and the father of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. But in his own right, besides being the son of a famous father and the father of a famous son, in his own right, he was a quite distinguished Talmud Chacham, an important figure in Europe, and later he came to the United States, where he became the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, a position that was inherited by his son, of course, when Rav Moshe died in 1941. Rav Moshe, prior to coming to America, had held a few different rabbinical posts in Europe, including serving as the town of Chaslovich. Chaslovich was in what today is White Russia, Belarusia, Belarus, and that's where young Joseph B. Soloveitchik spent much of his youth, where his father was the rabbi. It was a small town which was a Chabad town, meaning most of the Jewish inhabitants were Chabad Hasidim, although the custom in the town was to hire a non-Hasidic rav of the town. This was the unique nature of Chaslovich. And Moshe Soloveitchik served as the rabbi for a number of years in this town. This story, which involves about Hasid, it's not clear when the story takes place. I had always presumed that the story takes place in Chaslovich, but a number of years ago I was told that it happened in the United States. This story happened in the United States because after he came to the United States and lived in the Washington Heights neighborhood of New York near Yeshiva University, he continued as the rabbi of a shul, which is, I think, still exists, so I think it was since bought by YU, and it was called the Moshe Soloveitchik Shul on his name. I'm sure it had a different name of its own. So someone told me that the following anecdote actually took place in New York, even though it involves an interaction between Moshe and Chabad Chassid, but the actual location and timing of the story are irrelevant. Once my father was standing on the synagogue platform on Rosh Hashanah, ready and prepared, Mukhan Zuman, to guide the order of the sounding of the shofar. As is the custom, the rabbi calls out the notes of the shofar, Tkia, Shvarim, Trua, and the Bal Tokeya, the guy who actually blows them in accordance. The shofar sounder, the Bal Tokeya, a God-fearing Chabad Chassid, who was very knowledgeable in the mystical doctrine of the Alter Rebbe, began to weep. The Alter Rebbe, the old Rebbe, is Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, also known as the Bal HaTanya, the founder of Chabad Hasidut. They, of course, were not contemporaries. Pictures next to each other should not confuse into thinking the fact that the much older, by 150 years, Rav Shneur Zalman is in color, and Rav Moshe's picture is in black and white, should not confuse you either. Rav Shneur Zalman, known as the Alter Rebbe or as the Bal HaTanya, was the founder of Chabad Hasidut, and he wrote one of the most significant works of Jewish thought and theology, and a foundational text, certainly in Hasidut, and that's the Tanya. And this Bal Tokeya in the Shul was a Chabad Chassid who knew the teachings of the Alter Rebbe very well. So they get up there, the guy says the brachot before the Tkiyat Shofar, Rav Moshe calls out Tkiyah, and before the Chassid can put the shofar to his lips, he's overcome with a flow of tears. My father turned to him and said, "Do you weep when you take the lulav? Why then do you weep? Why then do you weep? Here you go. When you sound the shofar." He says, "What are you crying for? Are not both commandments of God? Aren't they both mitzvot?" Period. End of sentence. The point is to demonstrate that the purpose of doing the mitzvah is to do the mitzvah. And kavanot and mystical meaning and mystical intention is extraneous. You don't cry when you take the shofar. You don't cry when you take the lulav, if you are a halachic man. Or you might say, if you're a litvak, or if you're a misnagid. But if you're a homo religiosus, or a chabad chassid, blowing the shofar has different meaning for you. And in fact, it might make you cry. But for the halachic man, the purpose of doing the mitzvah is the actualization of the halacha in this world. And therefore, it doesn't matter which mitzvah you do it. Just do it, as the slogan goes. And leave the kavanot and the mystical meanings out of it. Now this story, this anecdote, has been the subject of, as you can imagine, this anecdote and another even more shocking anecdote, which we'll get to in, I don't know, about 15 pages or so, but I won't give away the ending. This anecdote has been criticized. It's been held up as an example of the kind of dry, soulless, heartless, emotionless, rabbinic outlook that, you know, can certainly be called in for criticism in the Jewish world. The question is, what is Rabbi Soloveitchik doing by recounting this? Anne asks a good question, which anticipates what Rabbi Soloveitchik is going to go on to say. So I'll skip her question for now, because you'll see that's precisely what's motivating the next page and a half. So the question is, what exactly is Rabbi Soloveitchik doing here? What is the purpose of this? When we say, just blow the shofar and don't cry, when we say that all mitzvot are the same, because all mitzvot constitute a fulfillment of God's will, and therefore really doesn't matter which mitzvah you're doing, is that to say that we're not meant to feel emotion? Well, some radical Jewish thought really does negate the value of emotion. There are some very, very, I find it a little hard to accommodate, but there are such views. It's not at all clear that that's what Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was saying. It's certainly not clear that that's what Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik is advocating. The fulfillment of the mitzvah, the external formalized ritual, is meant to be performed. But inside, one can be full of raging emotion, full of flowing feeling. But that is meant to be contained within the performance of the mitzvah. So there are different ways to read what the halachic man here epitomized as Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And towards the end of the book, the Rav kind of points out that the only real halachic men were, you know, were his father, his grandfather, and his uncle. As it could be that in the real world, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Yes, sorry about that. My microphone got disconnected. I'm not sure I got put off, but just to summarize, the question of the role of emotion in in within the halakhic man's worldview, is it negated or is it tamed and contained within the framework of the ritualized halakha? Now, interestingly, there's a story that when the Rav and his father were parting company, I think it's when Rav Moshe was going off. Rav Moshe, the father, preceded the son to the United States. So they're on like the train platform in Warsaw or something, and around the late 1930s. I'm not sure exactly. I can look it up. Their parting company. This was like the closest relationship that you can imagine. Rav Moshe was the Rav's principal and only teacher. They studied together 18 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week, throughout young Yosha Bear's life until he went off to the university. And here they are, their parting company. One is going off to America, the other is going off to Berlin. And, in those days, like, who knew if you'd ever see each other again? And, they give like a kind of cold handshake and say, a bi gesund, or something like that. And it wasn't emotion. But the Rav points to the story is to say that the emotion was all inside. It was all contained with inside. But you shouldn't be confused to think that the outer cold demeanor was an indication that there was no flame burning on the inside. One presumes that the Rav had a pretty good insight to his father's inner realm, but the idea being that there are certain things that are meant to be kept private, as opposed to our contemporary trends of everybody going onto Oprah's couch and spilling their guts and articulating every emotion they're feeling with the accompanying emoticon broadcast over Facebook and WhatsApp and etc. The halachic man is far more reticent than all that. But not so the homo religiosus, although I'm not sure the homo religiosus uses Facebook. The homo religiosus is a man of passions, religious passions. That's the chassid. So that's the anecdote. But then, for another 2.5 pages, almost parenthetically, Rabbi Soloveitchik explains to us the religious worldview of Chabad Hasidut and the symbolism of lulav versus the symbolism of shofar in that religious system, and why one would cry for the shofar and why one would rejoice for the lulav. And we have to ask ourselves, what is the point of this? Having brought this story as a kind of having brought the story to explain the worldview of the halachic man, which inherently is a kind of critique on the religious worldview of the homo religiosus, why does he now spend 2 pages outlining the sources in Chabad Hasidut for the homo religiosus, for the Chabad Hasid? It's an interesting question, but let's go through the material first. And now he tells us the mystic understands the symbolic significance of sounding the shofar, the concept of a plain note, whereby man attempts to pierce through lawful existence and reach the throne of glory, the Atik Yamin, the ancient one, the Deus Absconditus, the hidden God. The sounding of the shofar, according to the outlook of Shneur Zalman, according to the outlook of the Tanya, of the Chassidut, of the homo religiosus, the sounding of the shofar expresses the powerful aspiration of homo religiosus to extricate himself from the strait of contraction, the divine realm of strength, and enter into the wide spaces of expansion, the divine realm of grace, and from thence to rise above the 7 lower realms, the cornerstones of the cosmic structure, into the hidden world of which the light of the Ein Sof, the completely hidden infinite God, gleams and shines as it were. Remember that chart how does homo religiosus react? Where is it? There it is. How does homo religiosus, you should all know by now, that, you know, here's the final exam. Final exam is just to fill in this chart. Cognitive man only occupies the material world, is oblivious to the spiritual realm. Homo religiosus acknowledges that there is a material realm. After all, it, you know, constitutes the home base for where he is, but he wishes to escape it and transcend it to the realm of the spirit, whereas halakhic man wishes to do the exact opposite. You know what the shofar is to the homo religiosus? It's the long-distance phone call that allows us, here, trapped in the material world, to call out to the heavens, to call out to the hidden God who's so far, far away. Wouldn't you cry? Man's weeping on Rosh Hashanah, according to this doctrine, according to the outlook of homo religiosus, is the weeping of the soul that longs for its origin, for the rock from whence it is hewn, that yearns to cleave to its beloved, not in hiding, the kind of hiding the separation that we experience from God when we're here in this world, but openly. The sounding of the shofar protests against reality and denies the universe because it's the call to try to reach that point of reunion, right? The anti-tzimtzum, where God has to remove himself from the world. We will reunite. The entire ontological pessimism of mystical doctrine can be heard from the midst of the shofar and its long, drawn-out sighs and short, piercing cries. When a person takes a shofar and issues forth a blast, he thereby protests against the reality that separates him from the Ein Sof, from the infinite, from the God who is hidden away. He groans bitterly and moans over his inability to leap over the mountains of being that divide his soul from the Creator. The shofar heralds the great and awesome eschatological day of judgment, the judgment of the day to come, when the Holy One will appear and fill his world with a terrible dread. And there's this quote from the Natana Tokef, the emotional highlight of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. V'tizkor kol hanishkachot, God remembers everything that's forgotten. V'tiftach et sefer zichronot, will open the book of remembrance, and may Allah be parei, and read out from it. V'chotam yad kol adam bo, v'shofar gadol yitaka, he'll call out on the great shofar, the shofar of the day of judgment, the shofar of the redemption. The cold mamadaka yishama, and the small, still voice of him. Umalachim yechafezun, the angels who tremble, chil radayo chezun, fear and trembling will grant. V'yomru hine yomadin, v'fkod al tzvam arombadin, ilo yisku v'enecha vadin. V'chol bo'e olam ya'avrum lefanecha kibnei marom, kibhakarat ro'e edro, passing in judgment before him, like sheep before the shepherd. The angels, quaking with fear, declare, the day of judgment is here, to bring the host of heavens in judgment. Judgment, Rosh Hashanah, Tkiat Shofar, means the ontal, again, within the worldview of Chabad and within the worldview of homo religiosus, judgment means an ontological weighing, an evaluation of fine, ontological existential way. Existence is being called into the balance, into the question, into the judgment. The attribute of judgment by its nature tends to tip the ontological scale to the side of guilt and causes existence to revert back to chaos and void. Therefore, in Rosh Hashanah, a person ventures to rise up from the divine realm of strength, judgment to the divine realm of grace, and thence to a God dreaded in the great council of the Holy Ones. Kael ne'eratz v'sod k'doshim. The pasuk continues. So that we want to escape. We want to get back. We want to return. Now that can be interpreted in the more conventional understanding of tshuva, or the homo religiosus, it's tshuva mamash, to literally return to a state of being where we're not separated from God by being in the realm of the material and the physical, but we will transcend back to the purely spiritual. Shofar, you cry during the shofar because it's proof that we're far away. It's proof that there's this division between us and God. We need a shofar because we have to call out with this loud instrument. And only once a year can we do it on Rosh Hashanah. I once compared it to, imagine someone you love very much. A parent, a spouse, God forbid, a child who died. And they're gone. Wherever their soul is, we don't have access to it. They're not with us. We can't pick up the phone. We can't talk to them. We can't see them. We can't touch them. That's part of what we mourn for when we mourn their loss. But imagine if once a year, for just a couple of minutes, somehow, I mean, it's almost like a Twilight Zone episode. If once a year, for just a couple of minutes, you could talk to them on the phone. You knew when it was. Imagine it's the first of the year. Or imagine it's their yard site or their birthday. It doesn't matter. But once a year, the date comes. And you know, on that day, for 3 minutes, you'll be able to speak to them. And then the phone call gets cut off. And you can't reach them again until next year. And all year long, you know that that day and that date is out there, and that opportunity, that window will open again. When it came time to pick up the receiver, wouldn't you be trembling? Wouldn't you feel that sense of awe? Wouldn't it be a very emotional time? I mean, think about it. I know people who go to visit the cemetery on Yahrzeit. Yeah, cemetery being like, you know, there is such a custom, you know, to go to visit the cemetery, to go visit the grave of the deceased on their yard site. Right? So I know people that go, they only go on the yard site, they don't go up to the cemetery all the time. But they do go once a year on the yard site. And, you know, on that day before you go and you take that drive out to the cemetery, wherever it is, you get filled with whatever kind of feeling you're feeling. But imagine if you could speak, that's Tkiyas Shofar in the worldview of the homo religiosus, of the religious man. And once a year you have this instrument that you can call out to God on, that can reach beyond the divide in a way that prayer, even the most sincere prayer doesn't. It's a different kind of channel of communication. So obviously the Chabad Chassidy picks up the shofar to his lips on Rosh Hashanah morning. And of course he's trembling, of course he's quaking, of course he's crying. Not so the commandment of taking the lulav and esrog, which symbolizes the longing of God, of man for God, who illumines, who lights up the path of all worlds, who dwells in the midst of reality itself, and who has contracted his light, as it were, in the form of concrete existence in all its manifestations. Lulav is the exact opposite. Now that's why we take the lulav and we shake it in all the directions, as if to show God is all around us. In the words of that old Uncle Moshe song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, down, right, left, all around. You remember that song? The symbolism of lulav is the exact opposite. And that's why Sukkot is man simchatenu, a time of great rejoicing. We go out into the sukkah, unprotected from our normal house, strong in the knowledge, encouraged in the knowledge that God is protecting us. We feel his presence in a more immediate way than we do the rest of the year. So when Rav Moshe says to the chassid, What are you crying for with the shofar? Do you cry when you take the lulav? So we, having read Halakhic Man, understand what he was saying. I presume the chassid had no idea what he was talking about. Because the chassid speaks a different, the homo religiosus speaks a different language than Halakhic Man. For the Jewish homo religiosus, for the chassid in this story, it's like telling a child falls down and scrapes his knee and is bleeding and is crying. And you say to them, why are you crying when you scraped your knee? Do you cry when you get a lollipop? It would be incomprehensible to the child. No, you cry when you scrape your knee because it hurts. And you don't cry when you get a lollipop because it makes you happy. You cry when you blow the shofar because it reminds you of how far away you are from God. And you rejoice when you shake the lulav because it reminds you and symbolizes for you how close God really is. These are two different experiences for the homo religiosus. These are two different experiences, and therefore they mandate two different emotions. But for the halachic man, they're all the same. Objectively, they're all the same. Perhaps subjectively, the halachic man experiences them differently within the corners of his soul, within the inner sanctum. But externally, objectively, for halachic man, all mitzvot are commandments. Right? Milton has that line, he also serves who also only stands and waits. You know, like the idea of a servant, or the idea of a soldier, or the idea of my son volunteers for MADA, the Magen David Adom, you know, like the Israeli Red Star of David, you know, like the Red Cross. And he goes and he rides around on the ambulance and he saves people's lives. He does all types of wonderful things. But a lot of times, it's just sitting around doing nothing. A lot of times, they're just waiting in the ambulance station, you know, at the ready in case there's a call. And they're sitting around, you know, really just doing nothing. Sometimes, you know, the whole day. And on one hand, that's the best because it means that nobody needed their help. Nobody got, nobody was sick, nobody was injured, nobody was anything. But on the other hand, you know, you realize that that's like a little boring. And I always tell him, Milton's line, he also serves, only stands and waits, that just being there at the ready is also a service. You know, in the army, it's true, there are people there are like Navy SEALs, and there's the guy who peels the potatoes. And on a certain plane, they're both serving their country, even though one is more glorious and presumably more dangerous than the other. But everybody's service, because you need Navy SEALs and you need potato peelers. Because without potatoes, you can't have Navy SEALs. So on one plane, everything is the same. On the other, we understand that, you know, they don't make, you know, I mean, the only kind of TV shows which have the potato peelers are the satires along the way. But on the real heavy dramas, those characters don't appear. It's only the guys that go and, you know, are part of the SWAT team. It's the same thing with mitzvot. On one level, all mitzvot are the same. On one level, all mitzvot are commandments of God. And when you do a mitzvah, it doesn't matter whether it's the lulav or it's the shofar, whether it's the common, you know, everyday mitzvot or the more remarkable, less usual mitzvot. On one plane, it shouldn't matter, right? A son is born to you, you do a bris milah. So, you know, any of you that have children or have had sons and have done a bris milah, so you know it's a quite emotional experience. It's something that most people only do a number of times, in your life, if any at all. Some people don't have children. Some people don't have sons. Some people only have one son. Some people have two or three or four. But how many sons does the average person have? It's a mitzvah you do, and it's a something important time in your life. And it's a, and then there's putting on your talis, which you do every morning. There's washing the tilas yadoyim that you do twice a day every time you eat bread. On one level, these are the same mitzvot, because they're both a reflection of fulfilling your obligation. On another level, we can understand that the inner experience, the emotional component of it, really does differ. And not just because one is a common everyday mitzvah and the other is a much more special life milestone. On the other hand, they really are both commandments of God. And this is part of the tension between the halachic man and the homologiosis. Avram asks, can we say that Hasidism, that Hasidut, is a type of homologiosis? Yes and no. The Rav is very careful to create these characters as the three main characters, the homologiosis, the homologiosis, the cognitive man, and the halachic man, as these kinds of abstract characters. Sometimes we've read the homologiosis and we've thought it sounds a lot like what he's describing. It sounds a lot like a kind of American Protestantism, you know, throughout the early and mid-20th century. Now, thanks to this anecdote, and whenever you tell an actual anecdote with actual people, you have to kind of assign these personality tags to real people. In this story, there's no doubt that the Chabad Chosid is playing the role of the homoreligiosis, and Moshe Soloveitchik is playing the role of the halachic man. It wouldn't be fair to say that all of Hasidut should be grouped together in the homoreligiosis category. But it definitely seems that with this particular Chosid, that's what he's saying. And to a certain degree, the degree to which Hasidut is a movement that's oriented around a more mystical worldview, although that wouldn't be true for all Hasidut, but the degree to which Hasidut is oriented around a more mystical worldview, and the degree to which the presentation of mysticism here towards the end of the chapter, not at the beginning of the chapter, because at the beginning of the chapter, when the Rav is appropriating mystical language, he's really doing it quite to bring it around to the other side, to appropriate it from its mystical content, the language of Tzimtzum, and to read it more from the earlier Midrashic tradition, the rabbinic tradition, to make his point about the halachic man's worldview. But the degree to which he's making an argument against mystical religion, so he does identify that with Hasidut and with certain practices, some of them influenced by the Kabbalah, and that is that seems to be clear here. The Rav here spells out a little more the symbolism of shofar and why within Chabad it's something that we could understand somebody weeping. He points out that after all, the Torah itself calls Rosh Hashanah the Yom Teruah, which the Targum calls the Yom Yivavah, with the sound of the Teruah, the plaintive middle sound. That we learn how that sounds from crying, that it's meant to sound like a cry, and there's only a machlokus whether it's a kind of cry that's plaintive and mourning, or it's a cry that's piercing, what we call the truah of, you know, the sharp, or it's the more what we call the shvarim, the broken cries, the groaning, the but they're both modeled after different types of crying. So the shofar itself, Hasidut would point out, the Targum already points out, is somehow connected to this idea of crying. In contrast, the Torah enjoyed special rejoicing on Sukkot. Snachtem ufnei Hashemelekei kum shivat yamim, says the Poskim Baruch. Halachic man, however, does not distinguish between the two families. He is completely immersed in the cosmos, whether on Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot. The mystics cleave asunder the barriers of the objectivity and the concreteness of the commandment. On a wondrous craft, they navigate the waves of a mysterious subjectivity that surges and flows, and is constantly changing its shape and form, that is always metamorphosing, always changing, assuming new images, different guises, and the waves come and sweep the craft along and carry them into the paradisiacal realms. So it's a lot of work to be the homo religiosus, because you have to be involved in with all these emotions, and you have to, I mean, this metaphor of riding the waves, you know, you're on your raft, you're on your surfboard, surfing the waves of emotion, the up and the down, the crest and the flow, right? It's very demanding. You have to have the right emotion for the right mitzvah. Not so is the manner of halachic man. He does not wish to snap the fetters of the objective form and demolish the iron bars and the firm and fixed wall from the sense world. Halachic man is quite comfortable with the objectified experience. He doesn't desire the subjective emotional. The Shekhinah, the divine presence, does not anguish over the mystery of Tzimtzum, or the descent into the empirical realm. Accordingly, halachic man does not wish to free her, the Shekhinah, or himself from this realm. Again, remember, it explains these two movements. Because homo religiosus feels so bad about being trapped in the material world, he desires, he quests, he yearns for, he cries about trying to get back. Halachic man doesn't mind being down, and therefore he's less subject to these torrents of emotion. He doesn't live with this risk the way that homo religiosus does. And therefore, the objective lawfulness of the this worldly, of the material, doesn't cause him the same kind of anguish. It's interesting that the Rav, after having brought the anecdote to demonstrate the worldview of halachic man, had to then, or felt compelled, to take two pages out of an essay that's only, 150 pages long? 140 pages long? He takes two whole pages, almost parenthetically, to explain the worldview of the homo religiosus here in the guise of the Chabad Chosid on Rosh Hashanah, who cries at the shofar and rejoices with the woman. He could have put it in his foot, but instead it's there in the body of the text. It could be that this is a kind of vestigial remnant of the original format of halachic man, which was an oral presentation. Halachic man was based on an oral presentation that was given before the Rav came, sometime in the late 1930s, before the Rav came to teach at YU. I once met somebody that was present at that lecture that he gave, that became in written form halachic man, and he told me that it was basically, you know, all of the, you know, the whole skeleton of the thing was already there in that oral presentation. And that the content of halachic man was already there in that oral presentation many years earlier. And this kind of anecdote and the parenthetical aside explaining the worldview of Chabad might have been something that you would say in an oral presentation, and might have been something that got carried over to the written text. which might not have happened had the whole thing been formulated from the outset as a written philosophical document. However, I think that he retains these two pages of explaining the Torah of the Alter Rebbe, the Homer Religiosus's, the Homer Religiosus as Chabad Chosid worldview about shofar and lulav, because I think he's saying something about the halachic man, something that he said in other contexts as well. He describes halachic man here. He's defending halachic man here. He's praising halachic man here. It could be that in all cases, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik himself did not fully identify with the halachic man. And one of the ways in which he did not fully identify with the halachic man may have been precisely in the realm of emotion. It may be that he felt there was more room for the expression of emotion in Judaism than halachic man allowed for. And it may be one of the ways in which he does not fully identify with this character that in all cases he puts up on the pedestal. In all cases, thinks represents his father, his grandfather, that these most significant figures in his life, but a way in which he was different. And to be clear, there were other ways in which he differed from his family traditions. There were also, of course, other influences in his life, his mother not being the least of them, although she herself was from a very distinguished rabbinic halachic man-oriented family. His other experiences, his other reading and learning and education, his wider education, and it expressed itself in different ways. One of the ways that it expressed itself was his embracing of religious Zionism. His father, his grandfather, were not Zionists. Now, of course, before and after the Holocaust, to have different views on these things, there are all types of reasons that one might accept a worldview that your ancestors 100 years earlier wouldn't have. But it was no secret that the Soloveitchiks were not ardent Zionists. But Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik did become highly identified with religious Zionism. He was a leader of the movement in the United States. And he says that even though his forebears did not identify with Zionism, he did, because halachic man is only able to see the realm through a halachic prism. And he was sometimes able to appreciate things on a kind of other map. And that led him to appreciate the significance of the establishment of the State of Israel in a way that maybe the pure halachic man would have overlooked. These are things that he states in a hesped, in a eulogy that he delivered for his uncle. When his uncle, the Brisker Rav, died in 1959, he delivered a hesped, which in Hebrew is entitled Madodech Medod. It has not yet been fully translated into English. And he used that hesped, that eulogy, as an opportunity to revisit the character of halachic man, as a way of describing his uncle's personality and character. And for all types of reasons, some of which I wrote about in an essay, which I think I've shared with you in the past, if not, I'd be happy to send you a link to it again. he makes the point that he, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, is able to appreciate historical events and hear perhaps emotional events in a way that pure halachic men were not able to do. I'm putting a link up in the chat to that article, which is called Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik and the Israel Chief Rabbinate. And that link, or if you just Google that, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and the Israeli Chief Rabbinate, you should find the PDF download. And in that story, which has to do with why the Rav didn't become Chief Rabbi of Israel when the position became open, there's a discussion of this larger issue of the halachic man and the role of emotions and things like that. We will continue from chapter 10 next time.